Hey, podcast listeners, it's Maria Hinojosa. Thanks a lot for listening to Latino USA. And if you like our interviews, check out Fresh Air, where you can get to know people like Jon Stewart, Larry David, Amy Poehler, Louis C.K., Michael Keaton, Bradley Cooper, and the creators of Mad Men, Better Call Saul, Justified, and House of Cards. All of that on Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts. From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, artists, composers, and performers who are taking traditions and making them their own.
Like, basically, the first two chapters of Hamilton's life you could hear on anyone's hip-hop album.
Playwright and composer Lin-Manuel Miranda on his hit hip-hop musical based on the life of Alexander Hamilton. Ever imagine a founding father as a rapper? And twin sisters bring a whole new take on traditional Afro-Cuban music and Yoruba chants.
You know, the best thing we can give is our music. It's not our booty, it's not my figure, it's really our music.
I go backstage with the fabulous Ibeyi. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Stay with us. No se vaya. La adolescencia, la fobia, mis primeras novias, deja que te cuente en pocas líneas esta historia. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. If you've ever seen a musical, you know that sometimes they'll sing a song, like, for instance, one of my favorites, Tonight from West Side Story. Then later in the show, they sing the same song, but sort of updated. That updated version is called a reprise. And bringing back something good and updating it is what this week's show is all about. From the innovative classical music composer Tania León to French-Cuban twins bringing their Yoruba roots into pop. But we're going to start with one of Broadway's most transformative stars, Lin-Manuel Miranda. The Broadway show he starred in and composed, In the Heights, won 4 Tonys, including Best Musical in 2008. In the Heights tells the story of a Dominican bodega owner in New York City. But Lin-Manuel's current show takes on a very different topic. 6 years ago, he was invited to perform at the White House Poetry Jam.
I'm thrilled the White House called me tonight because I'm actually working on a hip-hop album. It's a concept album about the life of someone I think embodies hip-hop, Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. You laugh, but it's true. He was born a penniless orphan in St. Croix of illegitimate birth, became George Washington's right-hand man, became Treasury Secretary, caught beef with every other founding father, and all on the strength of his writing.
Hip-hop Hamilton hit the stage.
Well, the word got around. They said, this kid is insane, man. Took up a collection just to send him to the mainland. Get your education. Don't forget from whence you came. And the world is gonna know your name. What's your name, man? Alexander Hamilton. His name is Alexander Hamilton. And there's a million things he hasn't done. But just you wait. Just you wait. When he was 10, his father split full of it.
Since that performance, Lin-Manuel has turned this rap narrative into a full-blown musical called Hamilton, based on the biography by Ron Chernow. And the show has caught a lot of attention. In fact, it's the hottest ticket in New York City now, all for a chance to see the founding fathers reprised as men of color, George Washington is portrayed by a black man, and Lin-Manuel plays Alexander Hamilton himself. I met up with him at the Morris Jumel Mansion, where he spent much of his time writing Hamilton in his favorite neighborhood, Washington Heights.
Hello.
Vice President Aaron Burr, the man who killed Alexander Hamilton in a duel, used to live at the Jumel Mansion. And Lin-Manuel actually wrote parts of Hamilton in Aaron Burr's former bedroom.
Oh, my God. And, like, we're behind the glass wall, the little red velvet line that keeps you out from any place when you visit a museum, and we're on the inside.
Yeah. So this is Aaron Burr's bedroom. For the year he lived here. I have a little 2-octave MIDI keyboard, and I have my computer, and I sit here, and I have a little desk, and just write.
So you were sitting on that chair, or you brought a different chair? You were sitting on that chair.
Yeah, you can say it.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I was sitting in that chair. I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, but yeah, I was sitting in that chair.
Can you tell me the story of how that happened, how you got invited to come and write here?
I did the performance at the White House in 2009, when I'd really only written that song, and sort of showed it undercooked. I joke that, like, I showed everyone an ultrasound in a month. But, you know, the White House calls and you have a song about one of the founding fathers in your pocket, like, that's a sign. That's not, you know, I'm not going to do a song from In the Heights if that moment presents itself. I'm going to do the thing I have that is relevant. And so I performed that song, and then through sheer good luck, that thing went viral. That had been circulating around, and they said, hey, if you ever want to write, like, in Aaron Burr's bedroom. And just like the White House called, hey, do you have anything on the American Experience? I went, signs and portents, signs and portents. And I said, yes.
Did something happen when you got here where it then...
Did Aaron Burr jump into my body Whoopi Goldberg style and ghost? No, it did not.
Oh,
but,
too bad.
Too bad. Oh, I wish. I've always loved this house. I think it's sort of amazing that we have this block in the middle of Washington Heights that is a cobblestone street, and you can just travel to the, you know, 18th century. One of the joys of writing this is learning. It's just as much a New York story as In the Heights was. It's just a few layers of dirt below.
What does it feel like to be the son of Puerto Ricans who is now completely identifying with the founding fathers and this two layers down?
First of all, it's the strength of Ron Chernow's writing because he made me see that. I knew the rough outlines of Hamilton's story. I wrote a paper on the duel in 10th grade, probably. And all I knew was that he had a son who died in a duel, and then he died in a duel 3 years later. I grabbed that book at random off a shelf. I just wanted a biography to read on the beach. I like reading biographies. And so I said, if nothing else, this is a good ending. You know, I knew he went out with a bang.
Was there anything for you at all, the moment, and maybe it was back when you were in 10th grade, when you realized that Alexander Hamilton actually was an immigrant to this country, someone who is considered our founding father?
I didn't know that until I read Ron's book. A lot of people don't know that.
When you realize that, what, and particularly from him being from the islands, as you're in your own family,
yeah,
does your brain just go pablam, or do you just put the book down and, do you remember?
It went pablam, and that doesn't often happen. One, because I've never said that word. You just invented it. But two, because it's such a part of the hip-hop narrative. Like, basically, the first two chapters of Hamilton's life, you could hear on anyone's hip-hop album. You know, a lot of the rappers we love, the narrative they talk about is having a very tough home life, having to sell drugs or be in the drug trade in some form and use that money to get out of their neighborhood. And that's exactly what Hamilton did. Just trade trading company for drug running. It's the same story. And then he had a verbal ability, and it got him out.
Birthdays was the worst days. Now we sip champagne when we thirsty. Damn right, I like the life I live, because I went from negative to positive, and it's all.
What's fun for me in the show is I live at the center of this very strange Venn diagram that encapsulates history, hip-hop, and musical theater. And I'm packing as much of all three of those things into this show as my brain can allow, and as your brain will allow as an audience member. And what's fun is watching certain moments detonate and register with people who live in any one of those Venn diagrams. So there are hip-hop references, there are Biggie references, there are Rodgers and Hammerstein references, there are lots of musical theater references, and then you get the history, who catch the nod to Sally Hemings in Jefferson's song. We catch the nerds who laugh at that. And so what's fun for me are those moments where everyone blows up.
You have forever changed how I see the Founding Fathers. When you think about the weight that that means, that you are actually changing people's image of something as core Americana as the Founding Fathers. Is that the ka-ching moment? Are you, or?
Well, I don't know that that's how I think of it exactly. What I did endeavor to do is make the Founding Fathers as human as possible, because it's a very human story. And I think we need to be reminded constantly that the people who created our country were human, and they had faults, and they had disagreements, and that our Constitution did not come down on a stone tablet from a mountaintop. It was the result of a lot of people with a lot of really different opinions and agendas compromising through, again, Ron's great biography of Washington. Suddenly I get Washington. Suddenly Washington's not just a stone-faced white dude. He's a guy who bears the burden of history at a really young age and is terrified of what his legacy will be.
Do you at all think of yourself as a Latino leader in that space in your head?
Reluctantly. No, I think of myself as a writer and a performer. And but that being said, I'm very aware of the Latinos who kicked a door open for us, of the Rita Morenos and the Raul Julias and the people who were the only faces like mine on screen and on stage, when you want to see yourself represented. So I am aware of that responsibility, but responsibility is the death of fun when you're writing. And when I'm writing, I'm just trying to tell the story as compellingly as possible.
Does it mean, I mean, of course, your dad, he ended up becoming a major political figure in the city of New York. One of the first most influential Latinos. He was not elected. He was behind the scenes working with the Koch administration, which is when I met him. So how much do you think about the ramifications of being now another generation of Latino who is doing politics in a very different way than your dad?
Yeah, I'm pretty allergic to politics in the nuts and bolts sense of it. There was a really lovely moment that happened. My dad told me about this. My dad said we were doing one of the run-throughs of the show, of Hamilton, and there's a song called The Room Where It Happens. And it's a song about the compromise that Hamilton got into with Madison and Jefferson, where basically, in exchange for Congress passing his financial plan, the capital of the United States moved from New York to where it now is in Washington, D.C. And this happened over dinner. Jeffrey Seller, our producer, turned to my dad and said, "Only your son could have written this song." Just like, you know, if you're a butcher's son, you grow up around meat. I grew up around politics. You know, the fact that in Hamilton, our cast looks like America looks like now, I think only enhances the immediacy of the story. It just makes sense from a storytelling perspective for us. But it does, for some people, have this political overtone to it, like, oh my gosh, this is what our country looks like now. And it will strike joy into the hearts of some and panic into the hearts of others. But there it is. It's a reality.
I'm just like my country. I'm young, scrappy, and hungry. And I'm not throwing away my shot.
Coming up on Latino USA, we take a trip from Washington Heights to Harlem so that Lin-Manuel can explain the significance of a statue of George Washington and the Marquis de Lafayette, which I see every day because it's across the street from my home.
In this statue, they're together?
But have you ever looked up at the statue across from your own house? It's him shaking hands with Washington.
Stay with us. No se vayan. Hey, podcast listeners, it's Maria Hinojosa, and thanks so much for listening. I just got to tell you, every time you send in a donation of whatever size, I want you to know that I'm signing those thank you notes. You know why? Because it means so much to us that you took the time to write a check. Remember, it doesn't matter how big or how small. It just matters that you do it. I hope you'll take a moment to go to latinousa.org and click on the donate button to support our work. And I'll send you your very personal thank you. Why? Because we mean it. Muchas gracias.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Lumber Liquidators, a proud sponsor of NPR, offering more than 400 styles, including hardwood, bamboo, laminate, and vinyl. With flooring specialists in hundreds of stores nationwide, more at lumberliquidators.com or 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and we're back with Lin-Manuel Miranda, the composer and star of the new hip-hop musical, Hamilton. We're in a cab now, going from Washington Heights down to Harlem, to check out a statue of the Marquis de Lafayette and founding father, George Washington.
What's amazing about Harlem, and one of my favorite things about living there, and this is going to sound crazy, it's probably not be on the radio, but I think of what would happen if the statues in Harlem came to life Night at the Museum style at night. And you have Harriet Tubman next to Lafayette, who is also very anti-slavery. You have Frederick Douglass over at the entrance to the park on 110th Street. And I picture them all getting up and kind of awkwardly looking at Washington being like, hey, sup? And Washington be like, I set you free after I died. Not good enough.
So tell us a little bit about Lafayette.
That guy grew up, he's basically French royalty. I mean, he was a marquis, but he was so impassioned by the news of a revolution. Washington and Lafayette very much had a father-son relationship and, you know, really became very close. So I think it's fitting that we're going to go see a statue of the two of them together because they would have been seen together.
They're together in this statue?
Yeah.
In this statue, they're together?
But have you ever looked up at the statue across from your own house?
Well,
it's him shaking hands with Washington.
Oh, my God. Okay. Right here.
Right here.
Yeah, thank you. Okay, no. So tell me. So, all right, I feel terrible because I always look at the back of it. Yeah. What are we seeing, Lin-Manuel?
We are seeing Lafayette Square, which I didn't know existed until I lived here.
Okay, so what? Now, when I see this, okay, and maybe that's why I didn't come and spend a lot of time here, because I would look at this and I'd be like, I don't know, these two older white guys, really huge, standing here, looking very tough-ish. I don't know if I really, you know.
Yeah.
So now...
But it's interesting. It gains something when you know their relationship, when you know how close they were, that really Washington treated Lafayette like a long-lost son, and Washington never had kids. The regard with which Lafayette is looking at Washington, it's kind of awesome. It's kind of touching.
Mm.
You know, this is not the way... You know, most of these guys, when you see them, they're standing in profile or, you know, look at the way Lafayette's leaning into Washington. I mean, the whole thing, the sweep of it.
You're right. I'd never seen it before.
It's really beautiful.
And there is a tenderness in George Washington's eyes, actually.
Yeah.
Describe the Lafayette that you see here.
What does he look like? Well, he looks young. I mean, he looks younger than most of these statues usually look of this era.
He's got the curly Q hair.
He's got the curly Q hair. He's got the ponytail down the back. Yeah, the payas.
Right. Now, describe your Lafayette.
My Lafayette looks like famous rapper David Diggs. but, you know, not dissimilar. Actually, the costumes are exactly the same. I do look at, now having been in the show, I have sympathy towards their boots, which are a tough hang, I can tell you, especially, I mean, they didn't have to dance in them. I have to dance in them. I have sympathy for the swords clattering on their sides, which we have to, you know, contend with while we're dancing around during the Battle of Yorktown.
I should look at the statue, and the message should be love between, you know, a father figure and a potential son. It should be, you know, the founding fathers who helped us get to this point. It should be patriotism. Yeah. It should be.
It's also the father of our country shaking the hand of an immigrant that helped win this country.
Ka-ching.
In the harbor now, see if you can spot him. Another immigrant coming up from the bottom. His enemies destroyed his rep. America forgot him. And me, I'm the damn fool that shot him. Alexander Hamilton, we were waiting in the weeds for you. You could never back down. You always had to speak your mind. But Alexander Hamilton.
That was Lin-Manuel Miranda. His show, Hamilton, will open on Broadway in August.
We will try to destroy your name, but the world will never be the same, Alexander. Yeah, I'm the damn genius that shot him.
Okay, mis queridos listeners, I'm just gonna let you know this about me. I love classical music. Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture is one of my favorite pieces of music ever. But I'm also a huge fan of new music, stuff that draws from many traditions and has surprises in store for people who think classical music is just stuffy. Composers like Tania León infuse their work with Caribbean instruments, Yoruba rhythms, atonal piano work a la Philip Glass, all of which adds up to elements that make their music a much more global experience. Tania León's compositions and operas have been performed around the world and have received countless awards. She was the first musical director and a founding member of Arthur Mitchell's famous Dance Theater of Harlem. Now she's in the process of writing an opera with Harvard African American Studies professor Henry Louis Gates about the Little Rock Nine, the group of black students who bravely enrolled at a white high school in Arkansas in the 1950s. León was born in Havana in the 1940s and was classically trained there. But Afro-Cuban music and other Cuban traditions have always found a way into her unique musical style. She joins us in our studios now to talk about her life and her music. Welcome to Latino USA, Tania.
Thank you, Maria.
When you're sitting back and you're kind of like, okay, because you are now 72?
Not yet.
Okay, well, you look like you're 50.
I know, everybody tells me.
You know, you've had this blessed life. You've, you know, performed in the most extraordinary places, lived in the most extraordinary places. I mean, you have to sit back and say, óyeme, qué vida, what a life. No?
Yes. I mean, I think that I'm blessed because, first of all, my upbringing, I'm the first musician in my family. We don't know. We really don't know, because my family, all the ancestries are immigrants into Cuba.
From where?
From Africa, from Spain, and from Asia. I think that is why I have such a global attitude and universal attitude. And I never discuss races, for example, because I think that is a social ill. It's such a construct. We sort of like lost our humanity, you know? I mean, it's like we are humans. But I think that comes from my family environment.
And you were how old when you left Cuba?
I was actually 23, turning 24.
So 1967?
1967, yes.
So at that point, or at what point do you realize, Tania, that you have been more time in the United States than the country of your birth?
Well, so when I start to revisit history now, and you're talking about the civil rights, you know, the most shocking thing to me, what woke me up, is actually the assassination of Martin Luther King. That is when I was just like, what? You know? I mean, in other words, I started realizing how incredible this situation was.
And as a composer, how did you begin to realize that all of that eventually was going to have an expression in your music? And how do you see it coming up in your music then?
Well, I am of the mind that I am a composer. I am not a black composer. I'm not a woman composer. I'm not a Caribbean composer. I mean, all of the definitions, I never hear them express when you talk about Beethoven, for example, or when you talk about Debussy.
So the only prefix that you really accept with open arms is composer?
No.
Not even?
Musician.
Musician.
Yes.
Simplemente.
Yes. I'm a musician that happens to compose, to conduct, you know, and that's the art form that I selected to express myself, music.
So it's interesting, Tanya, because one of your most recent projects is firmly planted on the roots of history in the United States of America. You are now writing an opera about the Little Rock Nine.
Yes.
Now, again, you want to be free and in the clouds, and yet you're saying, I'm going to write the first opera with Henry Louis Gates doing the libretto of the Little Rock Nine, the moment of civil rights confrontation here in the United States of America. Why?
I was really in shock, you know, when I started realizing what was going on when I arrived. And nowadays, anytime I think at the moment that I arrived here, now is that I understand how incredible that was, that I was in the middle of all of that. So therefore, I mean, all of these things are incredible. And then now, but things such as doing a performance in Geneva, you know, Switzerland, for the celebration of the rights of women for the United Nations, things like that, things that happen that you don't understand. How did this happen, you see? And now this project, with Gates doing this, when he tells me that he saw this when he was 7 years old, and he saw this situation happening on television, and that nowadays he has personal friendship with some of the protagonists. So, I mean, it's like magic in a way.
So this morning, Tanya, as I was listening through again to much of your music,
yeah.
So I'm just going to say the name of the song, and then I'm going to share some words that came up for me this morning.
Yes, yes, they're pieces. We call them pieces because
pieces.
It doesn't have
exacto.
They don't have a singer.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
So indígena.
Indígena.
And then I wrote down the words. I was like, free jazz classical. Okay. Is that, what do you think? You like that?
I love that. I love that. You know why? Because one of the things that really, I mean, it was like a bang in my head when I arrived in the United States was jazz. And the first CD that was, I mean, CD, no, it was a vinyl of Art Tatum. And when I heard that, I sat down and I said, my God, I don't know how to play the piano. You know, who is this person?
Okay, so I'm going to give you another one, all right? The piece is Inura. Okay, so the words that I wrote down, gospel en español, ópera.
That is fantastic. Let me tell you, Inura is based on influence of Brazil. I went to Bahia and I fell in love. It was just amazing.
That was where my honeymoon was.
Really? The culture. I dance in the streets with the capoeira people and the people, the samba.
It's just magic, right?
It's magic. They go in the streets, people start following, tourists, everybody is converted into something that we don't know what. We're dancing behind the drums. I mean, it's just absolutely unbelievable.
And for all of that, Tanya, for all of your older pieces and for all of your newer pieces and for whatever you dream in that cloud that you live in, we just want to say thank you so much for all of your work and for spending some time with us on Latino USA. It's been beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Maria.
Siempre que te pregunto qué, cuándo, cómo y dónde, tú siempre me respondes. Quizás, 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 y así pasan los días y yo desesperando y tú contestando. Quizás, quizás, estás perdiendo el tiempo. Pasan los días y yo desesperando y tú contestando. Quizás, quizás, quizás.
Coming up on Latino USA.
Even if they don't understand Yoruba words, they connect with this music because there's really something about it that is special.
Bringing Yoruba religious chants up to date. I join Ibeyi backstage. Stay with us, no se vayan.
Desesperando y tú contestando. Quizás, quizás, quizás estás perdiendo el tiempo.
Hey, podcast listeners, did you know that Amy Poehler is a self-proclaimed snoop who reads people's journals? Or that John Waters was a judge at the porn Oscars?
Well, you'd know all of this if you listened to Fresh Air with Terry Gross. You'll hear surprising stories from the artists, authors, and journalists that you know and get a chance to discover new ones. You can find Fresh Air's podcast at npr.org/podcasts.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the advancement of international peace and security. More information is available online at carnegie.org. And Inada, maker of the Dreamwave massage chair, Japanese-crafted with shiatsu point detection and 16 pre-programmed massages, including morning, night, and full-body sessions. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we've been talking about the reprise, when the old comes back, and suddenly it's new again. Now, two new artists who are working with some very old traditions.
Even if I feel the sun on my skin every day, if I don't feel you.
The band Ibeyi is Naomi and Lisa Kunde Diaz, twin sisters.
If I don't see you, take me take me.
They transform Afro-Cuban religious chants into modern experimental pop songs. And, well, they're kind of blowing up right now. I sat down to chat with Naomi and Lisa backstage before their sold-out show at the Music Hall of Williamsburg in Brooklyn.
So you just turned 20?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you guys, like, totally do not look nervous at all.
For the moment.
She's really nervous.
Wait 1 hour and I will start.
She's really
feeling really nervous, yeah.
I'm cool.
So what do you get nervous about?
I get nervous because I want to do my best, and I think I put a lot of pressure on me, which is a good thing.
She thinks too much, though.
Yeah.
You talk about the fact that you are twins, but you're very different.
Yes.
And it seems like, you know, you don't get upset at the fact that your sister is criticizing you, Lisa.
Oh, she's criticizing me every day.
So I'm not criticizing her. It's true that she thinks too much.
I mean, we balance. I know that I think too much. But I know that she's too impulsive. So it's always like that. We balance each other, which is a good thing.
Lisa composes the songs and plays piano. Naomi plays percussion, and both of them sing. Their background is quite the blend. They grew up in Paris. Their mother is French-Tunisian, but was raised in Venezuela. And their father, Anga, was Cuban, a conga player in the Buena Vista Social Club, considered one of the greatest Latin percussionists who ever lived. But he died suddenly of a heart attack when the girls were just 11. And soon after, their older sister died of an aneurysm. These tragedies brought the girls closer together and spurred them to write music. Spend some time with them, however, and right away you realize they have totally different personalities.
So, Lisa, I wanted to ask you about, you know, the relationship between the both of you and how you represent different things. Mm-hmm. And Naomi, you say that you are, you know, if you were doing an album, it would be gangster hip hop, you know,
she's
rap.
Saying that.
That's what she says. That's what you say about
your
sister.
Yeah, I'm sure. Trap music for clubs.
Trap music for clubs.
I'm into trap music, so yeah, maybe.
And yet, Lisa, when people talk about your work, there's an element of the sadness.
Yeah. Gosh, if she would do an album alone, everybody would cry.
I think there's something important to say. When I started writing for this album, my way to write was, oh, I'm in pain, I will write. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, there's sadness. But at the same time, for me, those songs are hope. Yeah. Those songs are joy, because those songs are my pain doing something better and doing something beautiful. So we did this album as an homage for our father and our sister, and we enjoy it.
The twins sing mostly in English, but their songs often have sections sung in Yoruba, a language of West African origin used in Afro-Cuban religious chants and prayers. The religion goes by many names, Santería or La Regla de Ocha, among others, and it combines African animist beliefs with elements of Catholicism. The twins were raised practicing Santería with their family in Paris. And in the religion, each person has a connection with a particular deity, or orisha. Lisa's is Yemaya, and Naomi is Chango.
So you're Yemaya?
I'm Yemaya.
And you're Chango.
Yes.
There are some people who are going to hear this who don't know anything about Chango or Yemaya or the orishas. So in your view...
The orishas are the divinities, and in the Yoruba religion, each one of them chooses their daughter and son.
So I'm daughter of Chango. Chango is the thunder. And Lisa is daughter of Yemaya. Yemaya is the sea. So we have a lot of electricity.
You know, when you are singing Yoruba, you are singing prayers
that a lot of people sang before
you. So there's something powerful in it. You can feel the energy. You can feel... Yeah, it's really strange. And I think that's why people, even if they don't understand Yoruba words, they connect with this music, because there's really something about it that is special.
Come to your river.
One of Ibeyi's most popular songs is called River.
It's a beautiful song, and my response to it is earth, roots.
It's about Oshun. Oshun is the goddess of the river. Biggest. It's about seeing the earth and being in contact with the earth. And it's about asking the river to wash my soul.
Carry away my dead leaves. Let me baptize my soul with the help of your waters. Sink my pains and complaints. Let the river take them. River.
Ibeyi's self-titled debut album came out in February, and it's been a huge success. When I asked the girls what it feels like to suddenly become famous, they laughed. They said, nobody knows who we are.
You saw your posters, right? You saw the posters on the street out here, right?
No. It's quite funny, because everybody's like, I want to be famous, I want to be famous. And I'm like, I want my music to be famous. But my face, I'm not into that. You know, the best thing we can give is our music. I do believe in that. Yeah, it's not our booty, it's not my figure, it's really our music.
Your music in and of itself is so powerful, but then I happen to look at the videos, and they're like, it takes it to a whole other level. And Mama Says is also...
The man is gone, and Mama says she can't live without him.
Their song, Mama Says, is about their mother's grief over their father's passing. The video features their actual mom sitting in an empty room, her daughters embrace her. And at the end of the song, they all sing a Yoruba chant for the divine figure of Elegua. Elegua is the Afro-Cuban divinity, or Orisha, that controls birth and death. Suddenly, as they sing in the video, Naomi bursts into tears on camera.
Usually I jump right down there in front of people. At this moment when I cried, it's because my father was here. It was really weird too, because he was really, I could feel him, but like, yeah, I want to cry now.
Oh, no. Oh, mamita.
Sorry.
It's okay.
I'm gonna cry now. Stop. Gosh, I have makeup on. I have too. It was one of the first time I could feel him like that. So it was really intense.
The man is gone. And Mama said.
I could stay and talk with you both for hours and just hang out and show stories, but I'm afraid that you have a lot of work to do because you're very famous. And muchas gracias for your heart.
Muchas gracias.
There is no life without him.
Ibeyi's self-titled debut record is currently available on XL Recordings. And seriously, don't miss out on it. And this week, my dear listeners, we end our show by traveling not just back, but actually around time and space in search of sabiduría, or words of wisdom, this time from Uruguayan author Eduardo Galeano, who died on Monday, April 13th, at the age of 74. Here's a clip from our first Latino USA interview with Galeano in 2001.
So many Latinos and students of Latin America in this country look to you as someone who is life-changing. I mean, certainly reading The Open Veins of Latin America changed my life. Is that a heavy burden?
No, I don't feel like a burden. I don't feel loaded by what I have written. I mean, remember, I think it was Jean-Paul Sartre who said once that writing is a useless passion. And I think it's a quite useful passion as soon as it allows you to be the friend of so many people.
And he remained a dear friend of ours, coming on whenever he visited New York City. Galeano was born in Montevideo, Uruguay, on September 3rd, 1940. He began writing as a teenager for a socialist magazine, then worked as a bank teller and a newspaper man before publishing his most acclaimed work, Las Venas Abiertas de América Latina, The Open Veins of Latin America, in 1971. In the book, Galeano tells the story of Latin America as a continent of open veins, where its blood and riches have been drained for the wealth of outsiders. Even though Las Venas Abiertas, Open Veins, became his most popular book, in the years that followed, Galeano spoke about his writing style evolving, becoming more poetic, and his views on the human condition becoming increasingly more complex. Galeano fled to exile after military dictatorships seized power in Uruguay and Argentina in the 1970s and finally returned to his home country, along with democracy, in 1985. He continued writing there, narrating a world turned upside down.
Points of view. In the east of the world, Western day is night. In India, those in mourning were white. In ancient Europe, black, the color of the fertile earth, was the color of life. And white, the color of bones, was the color of death.
He went on to write more than 30 books, including Soccer in the Sun and Shadow and Memory of Fire, a trilogy of Latin American history,
one of his most accomplished works. History was one of Galeano's greatest obsessions, but...
I was a very bad student of history. For me, it was like speaking with corpses or visiting a museum of heroes in who I could not recognize myself, never. They were perfect in the uniforms, and they were saying long, long sentences. Even at the last moment, when they were dying, they would pronounce tremendous speeches, dying in the battle. And I, for the people in my country, and I've had the glorious days, and they are dying. How could they speak so long? So I felt that this past was not my past.
I just love the sound of Galeano's laugh. It's a beautiful memory for me. But he told the stories of the world from a very different perspective, just like we do here at Latino USA.
I was educated in the cafes of Montevideo. And there I learned that the past could be told as present. In the cafes, when some anonymous but great storytellers were speaking about the past.
Through his storytelling, Galeano made history his own. And that's why he found a home here with us. He came back in 2009, 2 years after he'd been diagnosed with lung cancer, and he told us where he got the strength to endure.
I feel it would be stupid to die because I have so many stories to tell.
Galeano's legacy lives on here with us in his writing and in his voice and in that unique way that he had of finding and telling the world's stories.
When I was a child, I thought that everything which was lost on Earth, at home, for instance, a scissor or a pencil.
A sock.
A sock or a book or everything was on the moon. And so time passed by. The astronauts went there. They found nothing. And not betrayed hopes or dangerous dreams. Nothing. That's the proof, the evidence that betrayed hopes and dangerous dreams are waiting for us here on Earth.
And for all of those hopes and dreams, we thank you so much, Eduardo Galeano.
Thank you. Thank you, Maria.
Oriol Val, que se ocupa de los recién nacidos en un hospital de Barcelona, dice que el primer gesto humano es el abrazo.
We love you so much, Galeano. Thank you for teaching us and the world about seeing life from a new perspective. If you want to hear all of our interviews that we conducted with Eduardo Galeano over the years, visit our website, latinousa.org.
Dicen que los viejos al fin de sus días mueren queriendo alzar los brazos. Y así es la cosa.
And, my dear friends, that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerejido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our intern is Laura Calzada. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Tumblr. And I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima!
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all. The Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide. And the Carnegie Corporation of New York, supporting innovations in education, democratic engagement, and the strengthening of international peace and security. At carnegie.org.
We said, oh, yeah, go. She was like, okay.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working with others to build a culture of health, enabling all in America's diverse society to lead healthier lives, now and for generations to come, on the web at rwjf.org. and Emily and Antoine Van Ochtmail, supporting New Futures, which works to help low-income D.C. area youth graduate from community college or certificate programs and become financially self-sufficient. Information is available at newfuturesdc.org. This is NPR.